some of your favorite WPFW jazz programmers as we bring in the new year with our annual day-long retrospective, celebrating the best in jazz from 2024. We'll spin a potent combo pack of our favorite jazz recordings from 2024. We'll pay homage to our jazz ancestors who transitioned in 2024, and we'll remember some of our favorite jazz performances of the year. The day starts with Herb Taylor, 5 to 8 a.m., followed by Candy Shannon, 9 to 11, Craig Williams, 11 to 2 p.m., Willa Jenkins, 2 to 5, Helen Vixens, 5 to 7, Paul Bailey, 7 to 9, and Miles Willis rounds out the day from 9 to midnight. Join us for our annual WPFW New Year's Day Jazz Special from your station for jazz and justice.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. Y bienvenido a todo mi gente escuchando en Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective Best of 2024 Year in Review. And as we close out the year, we take a look back on some of the issues covered by highlighting some of the most important topics covered by our best guests. And since we covered so much this year, we're doing a two-part episode on the year that was. And so today's episode covers some of the most compelling international stories in Latin America. Part two will highlight the most important domestic stories covered on the show. And so to begin, although the focus of the Latino Media Collective is on Latin America and the Caribbean, the ongoing Israeli assault on the Palestinian people in Gaza was unavoidable, especially when Israel has an extensive history of selling arms and supporting authoritarian governments throughout Latin American history. For example, here's an interview we did in April with Mark Lewis Taylor, who's a professor of theology and culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey, about how Israel's disregard for indigenous peoples included arming and supporting Guatemala's dictatorship in the early 80s. You presented a lot of important dates that point to direct involvement by Israel in Guatemala's dictatorship in the 1980s. But let's begin in 1977 during the Jimmy Carter administration, when the U.S. cut off most of its military aid to Guatemala due to its notorious record of human rights abuses. So beginning here, can you explain the Israeli government's role at the service of the U.S.? Because looking over this article, which was fantastic, it almost sounds similar to the Iran-Contra scandal that would develop almost a decade later.
Interesting comparison. You're right to begin with this date of 1977. Israel did have connections to various points throughout Latin America before then, the history shows, but this was the very important date because U.S. President Jimmy Carter comes in after being president for 1 year, and he had this commitment, at least announced, didn't always follow through, but this announcement to defend human rights everywhere. So he cut off most of the military aid, as you said, to Guatemala due to a quite abysmal record on human rights. Soon thereafter, Ronald Reagan becomes president, and the state of Israel was used to as a kind of proxy to supply military aid to Guatemala, because still Reagan couldn't, in a forthright manner, there was still struggle to get rid of the ruling by Jimmy Carter and to get around Congress. But Israel eagerly stepped in, and in fact, it's something that Israel wanted to do in many parts of Latin America and other parts of the world too. In fact, Israel, according to one journalist in NACLA, North American Council on Latin America, said that Guatemala had as its principal military supplier Israel. In 1980, just 3 years after Carter, the army was fully re-equipped with Galil rifles. Those are the Israeli-manufactured weapons at a cost of some $6 million. And then in later years, Guatemalan military elites would boast of the role that Israel was playing. Throughout the article, I give other examples of Israel stepping in, Israel being acknowledged by Benedicto Garcia, one of the leading military generals of the time, by other figures as well. And there are a number of signs. We could go into them, but can I give you one of the most obvious modes of involvement at the time with the village of Dos Heres in 1982?
Yeah, I was going to mention that, but go ahead. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's an infamous massacre, one of many. There were some 500 villages destroyed, so it's important that we don't just center on one. But the Israeli connection there was clearly present. And I compared several reports of this, but at the village of Dos Heres on December 6, 1982, Israeli-trained commandos left the village completely burned down. After shooting, there was torture, raping over some 200 villages. A UN investigative team reported, and let me quote from it, I have it here, all the ballistic evidence recovered corresponded to bullet fragments from firearms and pods of Galil rifles made in Israel. That's a translation of a report in the Spanish. It's a 12-volume study. The study of this has been exhaustive in Guatemala. And as I say, that's just the one village. That same 12-volume study reports that Israel-made rifles were present all through the highlands. And U.S.-made helicopters often ferried troops into the highlands for what the report argues were acts of genocide. And in fact, the report takes over 100 pages in its second volume to defend its usage of the term genocide.
So before we continue, I want to emphasize something that you just mentioned, that what we're discussing here is not exclusive to Central America. It's not exclusive to Latin America. That
indeed,
the Israeli government has been involved in some form of undermining democracy in various other parts of the world. We just did a show a few weeks ago with regards to the struggle for social justice in Honduras in the 1980s, and we indirectly mentioned Israeli assistance during the dictatorship in Honduras during that same time period as well. I'm Salvadoran, and I've been knowledgeable about some direct and indirect Israeli interference around that same time as well. One country doesn't really prove much, but when you add all these other countries together, now you have a theory, which you just mentioned, is sort of Israel being a proxy of the U.S. to circumvent U.S. law, which is why we started with that issue with Jimmy Carter not sending military aid to Guatemala in the first place. So
yes,
I want to go now to sort of your own personal history in Guatemala, because you were in Guatemala in the 80s when you first started making connections with Israel and Guatemala's dictatorship. Can you tell us about some of the red flags that you saw firsthand during your time in Guatemala that sort of galvanized you to study this connection further?
Yeah, when I first went to Guatemala in 1987, I went there as a young professor who was interested in setting up an exchange program for our students and some other students in Guatemala. And I wanted to go there and talk to people on the ground about the best way to do that for all parties concerned. I had also been involved in the United States in some solidarity work with Central America in order to cease U.S. funding of many military governments throughout Central America. So I went in with that kind of knowledge of the human rights abuses in Guatemala and the need to organize against them. I tell in the article the story of walking along a street with one of my colleagues that I was visiting with, and there comes this very loud barking order over a loudspeaker. It's kind of Darth Vader-like, and it's a little higher pitched, and it startles one. And I said, "What is that?" to my colleague. And he said, "Oh, here you have the latest import from Israel, these new Jeeps." I think they were military or police Jeeps that had come into the market, into Guatemala. And this got me thinking, Israel and Guatemala, what is that about? I mean, I went in knowing that the U.S. was a big funder, but I did not know about this important proxy role that Israel played. And just asking a few more questions to my colleague, it became apparent that Israel was supplying the Guatemala military and police with not only Jeeps like this, but training, equipment for surveillance of really quite a sophisticated sort at that time, as I'm told, as well as other kinds of military equipment. And ever since that time, I've been exploring the connection, at least at the activist level in the United States. I didn't make myself anything like an expert on Gaza or Israel, but this connection stayed with me and it was fascinating. And so more recently, I had to research and go more deeply into it. And I just wanted to comment on one of the last things you said concerning how widespread this is. You mentioned El Salvador, you mentioned Honduras. There are more materials than I could reference in this article showing how involved Israel has been in Latin America, all over Latin America. I just might recommend to your reviewers, this is what I do in the classroom, recommend a book. There's one by Bishara Bahba, B-A-H-B-A-H, who wrote a book called Israel and Latin America, The Military Connection. Came out in the mid-80s, in fact. I didn't know about it at the time, but it's a very good book. And it has a special chapter called The Special Case, which is all about Guatemala. So it gives you a picture of the whole, and it also lifts up the Guatemalan situation that I was writing about and that I had learned about.
And it goes back to what I said at the introduction, that this should be a very crucial frame of reference with regards to everything that's happening in recent times. But
yes,
before we get to recent times, there's still a lot more here that needs to be discussed, because although there was no social media to cover the Guatemalan genocide in the same way as we see Gaza today, there seems to have been quite a few red flags that pointed to Israeli involvement. So, for example, in your article, you cited Alan Nairn during his time at the Washington Post when he interviewed a Green Beret who openly talked about the use of Israeli-made firearms, which you just mentioned, and quote-unquote destroying towns.
Yes.
So you sort of mentioned this already, but I want to know if you could expand on this a little bit more, because it's quite shocking looking at the articles from both Alan Nairn and your recent article in Counterpunch to see how brazen people were during that time period and saying, yeah, Israelis supported us. They're helping us right now, destroying towns, in the words of this Green Beret.
Yes. And he is just one who acknowledged up front, at least a couple presidents make mention and thank the Israeli advisors. There were about 200 to 300 of them in the country at one crucial point in the late 70s and early 80s. I document that in the essay and trace those who have documented it very carefully. The general, one of the leading generals for Israel that was involved in overseeing Gaza for a time and was a hero of the early paramilitary moves by Israel against Palestinians, he points out that generals and those trained in the military in Israel were interested in looking all over the world for places to exercise their skills. I'm verging a bit more into the Gaza thing, but what's crucial here for understanding what's going on and was going on in Guatemala at this time is that the Palestinian territories were seen as kind of a laboratory for testing military weapons that then could be sent elsewhere. And one sees this carried out in numerous ways. I may just give you one more example here. One of the generals, again, Benedicto Lucas Garcia, who was involved in the sweeps across the highlands against the Maya peoples, he expressed appreciation for what he called, quote, the advice and transfer of electronic technology from Israel. This when he was speaking at a special ceremony opening the Guatemalan Army School of Transmission and Electronics. And this kind of speech even made it into the Manchester Guardian, as I show. So this is not known extensively to the U.S. public, but it was acknowledged openly in Guatemala that Israel had this connection.
Because of Israel's dark history in Guatemala and similar cases throughout Latin America, it should come as no surprise that such a frame of reference has led to strong support in Latin America to the plight of Palestinians in Gaza. Another fantastic guest we had this year was Jorge Garza, who's a postdoctoral researcher at Binghamton University in New York on how solidarity with Palestine extended beyond recent events. And I want to know if you could explain how Cuba played a role, if not a central role, in the development of Palestinian solidarity in Latin America, especially with the equation of Zionism with racism. And I ask this for two reasons. One, I mentioned the 50s and the 60s. This was also a period of a decolonization movement in continental Africa, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific Islands. And also mention this because if you'll notice, especially in the last 12 months alone, there have been a lot of protests on college campuses with students as I said before, equating Zionism with racism. So this concept, which people may think is new or recent, again, goes back to something that's been discussed as far back in the 50s and 60s as it pertains to the concept of Zionism and racism, at the very least here in the Western Hemisphere.
Great question. Yes, there's a lot in there. I mean, you know, as with anything else, our language, our perspectives evolve, our, you know, geopolitics evolve and take different meanings across time. And I like how you made that connection with the contemporary discourse around Zionism and racism. We're seeing a lot of campuses actually rewrite their student codes, right, and policy to do the inverse and equate anti-Zionism with racism or discrimination, right? And we see the weaponization of that sort of discourse to silence critique. And so going back, you know, to your first question about Cuba, so your listeners probably well aware of this, you know, that Cuba was at the forefront of the global, you know, anti-colonial struggle, anti-imperialist struggle in the 1960s, not only in while it was aligned with the Soviet Union, but also in breaking in a lot of its sort of, you know, political positions from the Soviet Union. As you mentioned, as I bring up in this article, the Soviet Union actually backed the creation of Israel during the partition vote, whereas Cuba was the only country in Latin America to take an active position and rejected the creation of Israel. From the 1960s on, Cuba took this sort of role, this prominent role, given its, you know, independence, its revolution, and its stance against the United States, to host a lot of gatherings, international gatherings of the anti-colonial struggle, and sort of became the host for a lot of these international struggles, bringing together, for example, the tricontinental, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And it was one of the first countries to give diplomatic status to the Palestinian Liberation Organization following the Nakba in the 1960s. It had the Department for the Organization of Solidarity with the People of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And it brought the Palestinian question, or the Palestinian struggle within the broader struggle for independence from colonial powers, and saw the struggle of Palestinian people within the larger global struggle against colonial powers during that time. And so Cuba was instrumental not only in Palestine, but also in Africa for what it did in the Congo and Angola. You know, Cuba, especially under Fidel Castro, really upheld those values of anti-colonial struggle and global solidarity by establishing these networks of support, whether that be medical assistance, military assistance. I mean, it was, you know, many African leaders, when, for example, Castro went to Africa, he was paraded as a hero across numerous countries during that time. Nelson Mandela, his first stop after getting released from prison was to go to Cuba and to thank Fidel Castro for what they did in Angola, which allowed the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa to regain its strength. So it wasn't just in Palestine, but Africa and a lot of the, you know, oppressed people around the world. And so it's no surprise to go into the archives and to see Cuba stand alongside the Palestinian people. And into your last point on the UN resolution, yes, this was in 1973. Cuba took the stance of sponsoring the UN resolution 3379, which equated Zionism with racism, which today would seem something, you know, so far-fetched given the sort of reactionary responses that we're seeing on college campuses and in popular discourse. But that wasn't always the case. I mean, the global support for Israel, and we don't have enough time to go over this history, but it took some time. And so as with any sort of colonial project, right, you know, it takes some time to produce a sort of counter narrative to history and justify everything that's going on. And that's really important to kind of pay attention as we read history, as we critically analyze these different moments. But Zionism ultimately is a political project. It's a project of settler colonialism. And so Cuba didn't find any difficulty in equating that with racism because it's predicated on the elimination of a particular people here, the indigenous people of that region, the Palestinians. Something that, as you mentioned, they seem so far away from us at this time, but in the 1970s was something that could actually be presented to the UN.
Yeah, you certainly made the argument in your article that Cuba played a central role in the 50s and 60s with regards to the Palestinian question. But as I said at the beginning of the show, Latin American solidarity with Palestine manifests itself differently from country to country. Cuba itself is not even necessarily central to solidarity itself. It manifests itself so many different ways in so many countries. We've gone this deep into the conversation and haven't even mentioned the Palestinian diaspora in Chile, which is something that I feel like it's a one-hour conversation in and of itself. As a matter of fact, we did a whole show on that several years ago about how that community even predates the Nakba and goes as far back as the late 19th century. Now, as an example of how this manifests itself in several different ways, you also make a comparison. Well, maybe not a comparison is the right word, but you certainly bring up the Zapatistas in Mexico in your article when it comes to Palestinian solidarity. Can you explain to us how this is sort of different from what we just discussed as it pertains to Cuba, but still leads us to the same road of solidarity with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian question itself?
Yeah, thank you for that, Oscar. So you're going to have to bear with me a little bit as we can deepen this sort of response, takes it into a deeper, more kind of theoretical place. And I think it's necessary here to understand the Zapatista intervention. So if we understand, so the sort of dimension or the lens from which solidarity, state-level solidarity, that is governments as they define themselves through their national borders, that sort of discourse of solidarity is organized around anti-colonial, anti-imperialism. However, the Zapatistas, and as a refresher for your listeners who may not be familiar with the Zapatistas, they've been described as a neo-indigenous or movement out of Chiapas, Mexico, that emerged in the 1980s. But, you know, as in their formal organization, make their public declaration in the Lacandon Jungle Declaration in 1994, and seek to develop an autonomous form of governance through different indigenous communities coming together and forming shared governance structure around caracoles and a rotating leadership and other elements of the conocimientos, the knowledges from place-based peoples. They are in Mexico, but not of Mexico, right? Mexico continues, even with a lot of these progressive governments, continues to dispossess, continues to exploit many of the resources at the expense of indigenous communities. One example is the Tren Maya, for example, that's currently underway in southeastern Mexico. So we have state level, which would be the progressive Mexican government, and then we have internal struggles within it of indigenous peoples on who the states were imposed upon. And so Cuba can build its solidarity as anti-colonial. They don't want, you know, European powers to intervene. But yet what happens when your own government is doing that sort of displacing and that exploitation, right? The sort of internal colonization that the Bolivian sociologist Celia Cusicanqui describes. And so solidarity from indigenous communities is organized around that sort of struggle, a sort of historical struggle that predates states and goes further back than just the 20th century, but goes back 500 years to 1492 and the expansion of Europe beyond its continent and the colonization and dispossession of peoples in other territories. And so I included the Zapatistas here because they do a great job in articulating and contextualizing what's happening to Palestine, not only within the Nakba, beyond just the Nakba and beyond even the 100-year history of imperialism, but going back to what enabled and what justifies this sort of dispossession is this colonial logic that emerges 500 years ago. So they make the connection between indigenous struggles in the Americas and Palestinians, right? Palestinians are allowed within the colonial imaginary and the colonial logic. You cannot exist. The existence of Palestinians at the same time that Israelis exist is a sort of distortion. And so that needs to be corrected according to the colonial mind. And the people that were there previously are made invisible either through real or imagined or indirect violence, right? I mean, this is the whole, you know, we can get into the whole historical imaginary for the United States, for example, and how it compares to Israel, the same way there's been numerous, you know, comparative studies between indigenous peoples. Stephen Salatio, I'm sure if you're familiar with, is a writer of Palestinian Salvadorian descent, who makes a lot of comparison between indigeneity and the discourse around the sort of savage terrorists and, you know, barbarians, in the same discourse that was used 500 years ago to justify the terror that's imposed upon the people that are already there. The prevailing, right, narrative around Zionism and the founding of Zionism and Israeli state is that it was a land without a people for a people without a land, right? The sort of imagining this vacant land, the same way that the, you know, United States Turtle Island was imagined. They needed to be conquered, and they needed to be taken over and developed because the indigenous people there didn't do anything to it, right? And so the Zapatistas do a great job in doing this sort of comparative historical analysis of placing what's happening to Palestinians and the sort of indifference within the global stage within the context of colonialism, and connecting the violence that they're experiencing there to the violence that we're experiencing in other parts of the world, right? Palestinians are allowed to suffer well within the grand, you know, powers that be because of what's going on in other places, right? So while violence touches down, colonialism and global structures of power are universal and operate across the globe, they touch down in very unique ways, right, in different places, whether that's Palestine, whether that's the urban ghetto, whether that's indigenous communities that are dispossessed for extractivism. But all of this is connected within this sort of colonial, modern logic of dispossession and exploitation, which we live under.
You're listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024, looking back on some of the international stories covered on the show. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024, looking back on some of the international stories covered on the show here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Over the summer, corporate media once again magnified their contempt for Venezuelan democracy by criticizing the results of this year's presidential elections without giving a proper analysis of the country's electoral process and by just taking right-wing talking points at face value. Leonardo Flores, who's a Venezuelan political analyst, activist, founding member of the Venezuela Solidarity Network, broke down what corporate media failed to understand in Venezuela's electoral process.
So there were 10 candidates total. One of them was, of course, the incumbent President Nicolas Maduro. Then were followed by Edmundo González, kind of the far-right candidate who managed to get most of the opposition vote. But in addition to those two, there were another 8 candidates who belonged to the opposition. So, you know, there immediately were already debunking this idea that somehow Venezuela is a dictatorship that does not allow for democratic political opposition to participate. They were fully empowered to participate. You had 10 total candidates, 9 in the opposition. And then the latest results were issued by the CNE, which is the National Electoral Council in Venezuela. CNE is the acronym in Spanish. They were issued on August 2nd. With 97% of the vote transmitted and featuring the participation of nearly 60% of voters, Nicolas Maduro won the elections, taking about 52% of the vote to Edmundo González's 43%. The remaining scant percentages, remaining 5% roughly, were taken by the other 8 candidates. Maduro won with 6.5 million votes, which is kind of in line with what Chavismo, the movement behind him, has gotten in the previous elections. And, you know, when we talk about elections in Venezuela, especially in the United States, particularly in Washington, people are immediately skeptical. And so I want to talk a little bit, very briefly, about what the electoral system looks like, because it's actually much safer than anything that we have here in the United States. So to vote on election day in Venezuela, you go to your local polling station, and when it's your turn to vote, you present your voter ID to, well, your regular ID, which serves as a voting ID to a poll worker. Almost every adult in Venezuela has an ID. We don't have that particular history of racism of impeding, you know, people from getting IDs like has happened here in the United States. So that's a non-factor in terms of everyone has an ID. Almost everyone has an ID. Almost everyone is registered to vote. So you present your ID to a poll worker who verifies kind of that the ID matches the person that's handed it to them. Then the voter scans their thumb on a thumbprint machine. That, if it's a match with your thumb, which is something that's necessary to get an ID in the first place, that match unlocks the electronic voting machine. Then you have this touch screen on the electronic voting machine, and you make your selection on the touch screen. The machine then prints out a receipt. As a voter, it's your responsibility to verify that the receipt matches your vote. Once you verify the receipt, you place that paper receipt in a secure box. Then you go to the end of the voting table where you place your thumbprint and a signature on a voting list. So this makes it an incredibly secure system that allows for everybody in the country, every adult in the country to participate and ensures that there can't be any sort of fraud in terms of people voting more than once or anything like that. At the end of the night, at the end of the election day, the machine prints out a tally sheet that is signed by poll workers and witnesses from political parties. So political parties are empowered to have witnesses at every voting table throughout the country. I think there were something like 30,000 throughout the country. And they get this copy of the tally sheet while the original is sent to the CNE. These tally sheets are going to be very important in kind of breaking down the allegations of right-wing fraud. So I'm just explaining that so people can keep that in mind. The witnesses receive a copy of the tally sheet. The original goes to the CNE. The machine then sends results digitally to CNE headquarters, where the CNE computes the vote and emits the first results once there's no chance of a reversal. The thing that happened in these elections, which we'll talk about later, is that the CNE was hit by a massive cyber attack, it claims, and that really slowed down the transmission of the vote and the emission of results.
Yes. So you kind of answered something I was going to ask you next, which is, what is the CNE in Venezuela? And obviously, I want to ask you about the issue of cyber attacks, but I wonder if you could explain, why did the right wing refuse to recognize the CNE results before the elections? And before the elections ostensibly means before the issue of cyber attacks even came about. I ask you this because oftentimes in U.S. corporate media, oftentimes they'll accuse Nicolas Maduro, the individual, or his government of interfering in the election results, but never mentioning this organization, the CNE, which the right wing has clearly recognized in previous election results, but nonetheless, they refuse to recognize the results of this organization, this independent organization, the CNE, before Election Day.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're asking that because it's really important to know. So in Venezuela, we actually have five branches of government. Like here, we have the executive, judicial, and legislative, but in Venezuela, they have two more. They have one called the citizens branch and then the electoral branch. So the CNE basically makes up the electoral branch of the government. It's a completely independent branch of government. They like to say that Venezuela has no checks and balances, but actually there are more checks and balances in Venezuela in the constitution than there are here, because we have this independent electoral authority that has the full right and duty to carry out these elections. On top of that, the CNE is led by a council of five members with alternates underneath them. And that council was, the makeup of that council was actually the result of negotiations between the government and the opposition. So they let, and the media here likes to say, oh, the CNE is dominated by Maduro. Well, actually, the CNE is made up of five people. Three of them are aligned to the Socialist Party and Socialist Coalition. Two of them are aligned with the opposition. Why is it that 3-2 breakdown? Well, it's because basically the Socialist Coalition has been winning elections over and over and over again for the past 20 years with only a couple of breakthroughs for the opposition, but not enough for them to take control of the CNE. Now, it's very curious that the opposition began saying that they're not going to recognize the CNE results. They actually said that they would recognize their own, in Spanish they call them actas, but these are the tally sheets that I mentioned earlier. So they said they wouldn't abide by the CNE results. This was about a month before the elections, only recognizing their own actas. And when they said this, everybody in the country was confused, because generally the actas that a party receives are going to be the same thing as the CNE results. But in this case, they had this kind of plot in the works. And on top of this, you know, you had this narrative being fed into, particularly into international media, with these polls that were pretty much fake. These polls were saying that Edmundo González had a 60% to 30% advantage over Maduro. And yet, even opposition statisticians and economists were calling these polls into question. You have one opposition economist by the name of Francisco Rodriguez. He's based here in the United States now, who did an analysis and found that these polls were wrong by an average of 27% in the previous elections, meaning that if, you know, they say that González had a 60 to 30 advantage over Maduro, 27%, well, that brings him down to what? About 43%, and Maduro up from 30 to 57%. So totally flips the results. These polls were totally flipping the results. And then on top of that, you had exit polls in Venezuela saying the same thing. But the curious thing is that exit polls are illegal in Venezuela because they had previously been used during a referendum in 2004 to seed doubts about the result. And so exit polls were banned. And then the one company putting out all these exit polls on July 28th, Election Day in Venezuela, was actually linked to the U.S. government. It's a company that basically does so much business with the U.S. government that it wouldn't otherwise exist if it wasn't for all the government contracts it gets. So you have this U.S.-based company feeding into the narrative of a Maduro defeat. You have the opposition claiming that they have their own results, saying that Maduro lost almost 70 to 30. And this, obviously, the point of all this was to make everybody in the country and internationally doubt the result. And the thing was, because there was a massive cyber attack at the same time as the results were coming out, the CNE was hard-pressed to respond in real time because they were obviously dealing with the attack and with dealing with finding a way to transmit the results. So it looks very much like a conspiracy by the far right to set this narrative of Edmundo González winning, to then set this narrative of massive fraud in the elections, knowing that the CNE wouldn't be able to respond because they were being slowed down by this cyber attack.
And as we wrap up the month of December, it is only fitting that we reflect on the 35th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Panama with two fantastic guests, independent journalist Michael Fox, the host of Under the Shadow, and Egberto Willis, the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. Let's take a listen.
I think it's important to understand within the context of U.S. imperialism, within the context of continual invasions and the United States pushing its agenda abroad, what this represented, kind of what we mentioned in a second, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was the so-called end of the Cold War. The United States needed to show its power, and particularly Bush needed to show that he was strong, or at least he wanted to. And so this was a way of the United States, and particularly Bush, showing that he was not going to be weak, and he was going to be strong against those evil dictators, quote unquote. And so Panama was an easy target. Of course, this was all within the context of the so-called war on drugs, right? That like fit with the same promotion the United States was pushing over television and in poor communities in the United States. And so abroad, it was an easy frame to shift away from the Cold War and to continue with the messaging of saying the United States, oh, it's no longer the Cold War, but now it's the war on drugs. And so it's an easy way for the United States to be able to use that as a wedge to continue to push hard against anybody it wanted to. I mean, they're still using the same thing anywhere, right? We've seen Plan Colombia, and we've seen the war on drugs throughout Central America, throughout Mexico. It's been the same discourse we've been using over the last decades, right? And so this was an easy target. Again, also Manuel Noriega, remember, this was a former U.S. asset. Like, he was literally on the payroll. And the only reason why the United States didn't like him anymore because he was playing many different sides. And of course, this was a place, Panama, where the United States had literally occupied for decades, like throughout the entire 20th century. So this is not a place that the United States is going to lose, but it's a place that the U.S. can show force and can take advantage of this moment to say, look, we are not going to back down. Yes, we've won the Cold War, but now we are going to win the war on drugs. And I think that that is really important context. And yes, we have absolutely forgotten it, but it's the United States playing the same imperialist game it has always played and using the discourse of so-called democracy and democracy promotion when in reality, it's all pushing its own agenda abroad for its own political purposes. And in particular, in the case of George W. Bush, who at that moment needed a victory, needed a win, he needed to show strength. And this is how he did it.
Yeah, Noriega can be argued as almost the original Juan Orlando Hernandez. But even then, that's sort of a misnomer because there have been plenty of Noriega and Juan Orlando Hernandez type figures throughout Latin American history in the 20th century alone. Egberto Willis, you're an Afro-Panamanian. I know this hits near and dear to your heart, especially on this 35th anniversary. The same question applies. Where do we begin to process this moment in history that, again, simultaneously is well-documented, but we don't learn the lessons from this well-documented event in Latin American history?
What is amazing with the story is it has so many different angles, right? Noriega was the perfect capitalist for the United States, okay? He was a capitalist. America had a need for drugs, and he was the one facilitating drugs to come to America. But the thing about it is there was a duality here. The purpose of the invasion wasn't solely about that shot in Panama City. It wasn't necessarily about drugs. As you know, as Michael just said, it had a lot to do with power. They wanted to make sure that Noriega remained the puppet of the United States and do whatever they wanted. They wanted him to invade Nicaragua. I said no. They then used the drug as a pretext to come in. But the other side that is so disconcerting, and I tie a parallel between this, and I don't want to change your subject, but even with Gaza, we cannot tell Gaza or tell Israel to stop bombing the you-know-what out of Gaza when what Bush did in Panama was to level Chorrillo, a place filled with Panamanians who looked like me, as well as Colon. He spared everything else. I mean, there are other places that, you know, assuming you really wanted to protect yourself against that, folks, there was no reason to go into Chorrillo and Colon the way he did. It just showed a disregard for humanity, just like Israel has shown a disregard for humanity in Gaza. But I tell you further, they did the same thing that they've done all over the place. They've tested, they used that invasion as well as another purpose to test new weapons systems. So that one invasion was not only devastating to Panama, but it showed the inhumanity of what we call our military that we use as an example around the world. We don't have the moral character at all to put down anybody who goes to war. That war was unnecessary. It was terrible. And to get one man, the UN says 1,000 people, I believe it was what they said. The UN said 4,000, America said 1,000. But we know how the tenements are laid out in Colon and Chorrillo. Was a hell of a lot more than got killed out there.
I have to say that the comparison between Panama and Gaza is really not off the subject because, as a matter of fact, one of Michael's guests on Under the Shadow actually made the comparison between Panama and Gaza today. And as a matter of fact, I have that clip here, and, well, let's take a listen.
Historian Olmedo Belucci says the region looked like Gaza today. He published the first book about the U.S. invasion of Panama to mark the one-year anniversary of the attack. He says some residents sought refuge in a nearby church. He says the United States promoted a strategy of looting supermarkets and stores to generate chaos and confusion. The financial cost to the private sector was estimated at $400 million.
I got you covered.
It took the United States 4 days to find Noriega, during which time the U.S. occupied the country and swore in a puppet government on a U.S. military base. The new U.S.-backed president was Guillermo Indara, the opposition candidate who had allegedly won elections earlier that year against Noriega's ally. So General Noriega, the de facto leader of Panama since 1983, had canceled the vote. Professor Olmedo Belucci explains that although Indara had participated in the elections, his was a puppet government because he was sworn in on a U.S. military base while the country was under invasion.
So that's another clip from Under the Shadow discussing the 1989 U.S. invasion of Panama. And I'll begin this question here with you, Egberto, because Michael mentioned here the issue of chaos and confusion by the U.S. military. Since you had family down there during that time, I'm curious to know if you could give us a few examples, a few further examples of the chaos and confusion that was created during that time period. I know that there are several examples there, but considering that you have family there during that time period, I wonder if you could elaborate on this. I know there was a lot to process in that clip, especially with the Ndara puppet government, but can you address this issue first, if you like?
Let me tell you, and this is very interesting. Most people don't know this. Our money in Panama is called the Balboa, but the Balboa is indexed directly to $1. And so we don't even print the Balboa hardly. We just use the American dollar. And the way that Bush started to come after Noriega to try to get the government to topple is that he stopped all dollars from circulating into Panama's banks. So therefore, people had no money. They got paid. Now, the only people that had dollars were the people who worked for the canal zone. Luckily, my father had worked for the canal zone for some time, and his retirement money was going into his particular account, and they had dollars. So the Panamanians who worked for the canal, they were like kingpins, right? Because they could go into the town and people would pay premiums for using those dollars. So people suffered. Commerce really came to a halt. People used IOUs, pieces of paper that says, I owe you this and I'll pay you when the situation gets better. So it was utter chaos. So on the economic side, before the invasion actually occurred, there was a whole lot of mental angst that the people were going through, both economically. They were doing all these kinds of simulated attacks and that sort of thing. The American government actually was. They don't tell you about that, but they were having these simulated attacks to try to entice the Guardia Nacional, which is the Panamanian Defense Force. They were trying to get them to go ahead and somehow attack the United States to give them a purpose to come in. And they never bit. They never bit because they understood what was happening. And that's why you see Noriega did what he did. But let me tell you a few things that kind of goes on top of what Michael was talking about. This is how bad things were. My father lived in a town called Arco Iris, which is on the outside of Colón. And there's one street to get into Colón from Arco Iris at that time. And there were people who were stuck in Arco Iris. It was called Rainbow City as well. People who were stuck there, and they would have the tanks all blocking the entrance into Colón. One of the people my father knew, his wife had diabetes, and she was trying to get her the medicine in Colón. And we had the army over there who knew nothing about Spanish. And this guy is in his hands in Spanish saying, necesito llevar la insulina a mi esposa. I need to carry the insulin to my wife. And he's walking up and they're saying, stop, stop, stop. And when he said, but she has to have it, they gunned him down and killed him. That was the norm. That was the norm. We have a building called the 15 Pisos in Colón. All right. They used the C-1, the gunship, the C-130 gunship. And they just opened up on the building, the 15 Pisos. They had the Cobras, I think it was, sending missiles into the, because they said they were small shots coming out of the building. It was reported that the stealth fighter, not bomber, was actually just kind of played around, I guess, to test it out there. Like, for what? We don't even have a radar to try to detect it. Or missiles to hit it.
My goodness. It's just another example of how the free movement of capital undermines democracy. Michael, there's a lot that Egberto mentioned there. And I don't have this clip, but you did point out the language barrier between U.S. troops and the Panamanian citizens during the invasion. I wish I had that clip because it's one of the few times I've heard Under the Shadow that I can clearly hear the anger in your voice of the fact that U.S. troops are sent there with little to no understanding of basic Spanish whatsoever. And so considering what Egberto just brought up here, I wonder if you could elaborate on this because that certainly lends itself to the chaos and confusion as you described in Under the Shadow.
It's just so disrespectful. I mean, doing an invasion is disrespectful, right? Doing an invasion is terrifying, but particularly an invasion in a country that they've already occupied for, at this point, 80 years. And the fact that they don't even, like, people there can't even speak Spanish. There's a couple of clips in videos that I used in Under the Shadow, I think that you were mentioning, Oscar, in which the guys are trying to get somebody to leave their house, and they're screaming at them in English. Put your hands up, come out, you know, with your hands up. At another point, there's another guy who's blindfolded and they can't even find a translator to like understand what this guy's trying to say. And he's just scared for his life. He doesn't know what's going to happen. They can't even speak his language. It's mind-blowing the level of not being prepared for something this level, something this shocking. And I think to take it to another level, it's a sign of the dehumanization that happens not just during war, which does, but also that the United States has continually seen the other as. And in here, we have a situation where even though the United States has occupied Panama at this point in the 1980s for 80 years, it's seen as the canal zone is the dignified, the advanced, the developed country in the world, and everything else is just savage, forest land, and those are the people that work for us, right? Those are the people that work our special canal zone. And it's this dehumanization that I think, Egberto, you were also mentioning beforehand, we were talking about how, like, the level of disrespect and the level of, whereas someone is saying, listen, my wife needs insulin, and there's not even an understanding of, maybe there might be, they're not treating other people as humans. They're treating them as, or enemy, or as literally just pawns, just things that we can just do away with because we can do anything we want to. And just to kind of hammer this home for a second, I was really shocked in some of these videos that were passed to me. And this wasn't the first time. I'm not the first person to see these videos that came out. This was one of the first times where the U.S. military actually went in with video cameras and they videotaped themselves. And then I don't remember how these videotapes got out or released, but they were somehow passed to people in Panama. And there's numerous of these videotapes. So it is an interesting time because, of course, this is before social media and whatnot. And these videotapes, there are very little record of the U.S. invasion, if not for the own United States that actually filmed themselves. And it's interesting because they're just so candid because it's their friends that are filming each other. But it's also like they're laughing at the destruction of El Chorrillo when they're talking about, woohoo, we hit this place and it's all on fire and the whole thing is going down. They're not just talking about military barracks. They're talking about people's homes. They're talking about the entire region. And it's shocking because these are the soldiers that are doing the bombing. These are the people that are firing the weapons. Right. At one point, the guys are kind of joking around. They're, you're a stud. You guys are just studs. You know, like they're joking around at the death of people. Thousands of people are being killed. People's home, 20,000 homes are destroyed and people have to flee. So many people injured, like families destroyed and cut off and all at the hands of the U.S. government and soldiers just joking. And what's frightening here is this is something that happens again with Abu Ghraib. It's something that happens over and over. We see it in the Middle East. This doesn't change. Like the attitude within the U.S. military continues. The U.S. invasions, the same attitude within the army. And so I think this is really important to point home, which maybe I don't dig into enough. I do get angry. You're totally right. In the Under the Shadows series, I am pissed. Because it's not just the level of, here's the U.S. government and they're doing this. But in this case, you see this really subtle, humanized reality of the soldiers themselves that are doing this. And yet they're laughing at it. Mm-hmm. And yet they're dehumanizing Panamanians who have lost their families and who have their back against the wall and are being invaded by another country. And they've already faced this U.S. enclave and this U.S. invasion that's invaded their country for nearly a century. And I think that this is something that it hasn't changed. And I think this is really important to remember on the 35th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Panama.
If I may add, because what you said is so true, but what is so hurtful and disconcerting is how they also treated the bodies. And, you know, very few people saw this. They just dug holes and there are places in Panama, went the destruction in Chorrillo. There are a lot of people that just buried underneath there. They are all there with the crap. Nobody tried to discern bodies or anything like that. They just used a bulldozer and just went over it. I mean, let's go under the pretext that Bush was really concerned about drugs. The same issue that we see with Mexico, where Donald Trump tries to go ahead and say, we're going to throw tariffs on you guys, etc. I wish we would have more responses like the Mexican president responded, like, by the way, do you realize if your guns didn't come over here, we wouldn't have a lot of killings? Do you realize that if your people didn't need all those drugs, we wouldn't have that transfer of drugs. It's not Mexicans that have the problem. It's you. And the same applies to when we had Manuel Antonio Noriega. The problem wasn't with Panama and the Panamanians. The problem was you're the ones that had all these drug problems, and you are the one that a capitalist took advantage of to provide you with the supply you were looking for. And it behooved me that to date, America hasn't seen that it's America who has the drug problems that creates all these externalities.
You've been listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024, looking back on some of the international stories covered on the show here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We thank everyone for listening and supporting the show and independent journalism throughout the course of the year. We'll see you next time. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Day, beginning at 10 a.m., the WPFW family and the members of King Solomon Grand Lodge will distribute to those in need all of the winter gear so generously donated by our listeners. Items such as coats, hats, socks, and more for men, women, and children are available. Support for our community begins at 10 a.m. from the Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast. Additional information at wpfwfm.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3000.